everyone, and welcome to this event being sponsored jointly by UK in a Changing Europe and our friends at the European Movement. Our guest tonight, I mean, I've got an introduction to him. I mean, it's Lord Heseltine, Michael Heseltine. You all know him. You all know what a proud track record he has in government and in public service. Just a few starters for 10. There's a QR code on the screen. If you click on that and go to the link, you get to Slido, on which you can post your questions. Now, let me just say, perfectly honestly, to start with, I've got so many questions, there is a pretty fair chance I might not get to any of yours in the time that we have. But if you want to take a punt, do so, and you can vote on questions for the ones you think I should be putting to Lord Heseltine, and if time allows, I will. I mean, we've got a lot to go through because you've had such a long and illustrious career, and there's several areas I want to touch on. I mean, firstly, your time in government. Secondly, I want to talk a little bit about regeneration and levelling up and all those kinds of things. Obviously, I want to talk about EU membership, the referendum, what happens next. And if we get time at the end, I want to get some of your reflections on the state of politics today. So, it's a very limited agenda we have. But let me start in the past. You've said several times, I think, that your relationship with Mrs. Thatcher was misunderstood. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think probably because I resigned from her government, there was, and survived to rejoin John Major's government, there were those who were her admirers who saw this as part of a conspiracy of me constantly trying to be difficult to Margaret all the way along. And then after leaving the government, organizing a sort of conspiracy to get rid of her. That's just so far from the truth. I never got on particularly well with Margaret. I didn't like her personally, but that's irrelevant because you're not in politics with many people to like or dislike.
I don't like anyone I work with.
So. Well, no, you don't need to. I mean, It's the difference between friendship and colleagues. But and Margaret had views of a sort of within the Conservative family, which would be significantly different to mine. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a party like the Conservative Party, you have a huge range of views. And you get together because, as a vehicle to power, you share enough with the rest of your team to be able to create a coherent government. So my relationship personally with Margaret was perfectly reasonable, although she knew I was much closer to centre than her. Mm-hmm. And I suppose this slightly counters what I'm now going to say. She put me on a list to sack when Peter Walker and Paul Channon and myself were featured in The Economist as people just about to go. And it so happened that I was, the day of this execution, I was actually scheduled to speak on behalf of the Conservative opposition, opposing a major piece of Labour legislation, and then go on to a meeting of hundreds of small business people with the leader of the party, Margaret. So I was very difficult to sack me then. And then the next October, I made one of those party conference speeches, which made me very difficult to sack. And so we had to work together, and we did. And the important point is that when we came to government in 1979, I was at the forefront of one of the most important of the issues of the time, which is the sale of council houses. And I also was absolutely at the forefront of the Thatcherite agenda of controlling public expenditure. I got rid of more quangos than even Keith Joseph. I reduced my department from 52,000 to 39,000 without sacking anybody or making anyone redundant in 3 years, simply by controlling recruitment. And I introduced management techniques for running a government department, all of which Margaret liked the look of and was sympathetic towards. Of course, most interestingly, when the riots took place in 81, 2 years into government, Margaret agreed that I would walk the streets of Liverpool to find out what the heck had gone wrong, you know. This was perhaps the most interventionist thing that any government ever did, you know. And then she promoted me. What to where? Defence. A, because she thought it was out of control financially, and secondly, because the battle for CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, was a major feature in the political horizon. So she put me there. And it is on the record that she told the then Chief Whip that she thought that I was her natural successor. So it is, the story is nothing like as simple as the supporters of one side or the other have it believed. It all went wrong over the fate of the Westland Helicopter Company. Yep. And that all got tied up with the European issue. And I resigned from cabinet, not because of the Westland affair, but because Margaret refused to let me put the case to cabinet. And it's a detailed thing, it's an interesting constitutional affront. My right as a cabinet minister is to be heard by my colleagues. She denied me that right, and I said I can't stay within this government. And I always hugely regretted, but never doubted for an instant that I could never have lived with myself if I had agreed to be silenced and the cabinet never given a chance to listen to my case.
We'll obviously come back to the Europe issue, but I just want to pick up on a couple of things you said. I mean, firstly, on social housing, there are those who date the current housing crisis back to your decision to sell off so much social housing. How would you respond to that?
Well, I have a total answer because, first of all, I'm totally committed to the idea of encouraging home ownership and the tenants to buy their homes. But the deal I did with the Treasury was that 75% of the cash flow generated by the sale of houses, council houses, would go into the provision of social housing. 75%. And that lasted until I left to be Defence Secretary. And of course, that's why we have now such a shortage. So my answer is complete and absolute. I believe that I was not only enfranchising the council tenants, I was providing a huge cash flow for more social housing.
Okay, so actually under the terms of your deal, it wouldn't have been the mass sell-off, that'd have been a purchase as well.
It would have been a major contributor to social housing.
And the other point, I mean, you were talking about conference speeches. I sort of just about remember your conference speeches in the 1970s. And one of the things that made you a darling of the Conservative Party were your attacks on the trade unions back then. At party conference. When you look at how this government is dealing with the trade unions, what do you make of it?
I think that not a lot has changed since the Labour Party produced a white paper in 1968 called In Place of Strife. And that confronted the issue, who governs? And the Labour Party, it was Harold Wilson's government, and Barbara Castle was the Secretary of State for Employment, analysed the issue about the power of unions and the use of that power. Because, of course, it was not only just the welfare of their members, it was the political agenda of extreme left-wing government. Mm-hmm. So Ted Heath's election as leader came in 1970, and the same issue faced his government as faced Harold Wilson's government. But Ted, and this is quite an interesting social phenomenon, Ted had to try and deal with the issue, the second prime minister to try and cope. Mm. And Ted, one of the characteristics of him and his generation was his wartime experience. So the men and women who served in the armed forces, and Ted did, had learned the interdependence of people, of classes, of social background. They'd been in it together. I mean, Peter Carrington, for example, commanded a tank. Well, if you're in a tank with a couple of guys from a working class background, you can't sort of see a social division as something that matters. You're all in it together. But that atmosphere was very much present in the period after the war. And so the idea of a confrontation, I mean, at its worst, civil war, was absolutely anathema. And that was all tied up with the treatment and approach of the unions, to the unions. Well, we all know the story of the miners, and that was a confrontation. Again, the same argument. Ted, if Ted had fought the election on February the 7th in 1974, I think he'd have won. He delayed. Why did he delay? To what extent did Peter Carrington and Willie Whitelaw influence him and confirm him in his desperate anxiety not to have a confrontation of the sort that was discussed? So Ted lost 2 weeks. And I fought that election campaign, and I can tell you on February the 7th, the Tories were sweeping the country. It was quite incredible. Right, wherever we went, good on you, well done, stand up to them, da-da-da. It was incredible. On the Monday before polling day, it all went dead. Bang. Everybody looked away. And Wilson, his reputed to have said, we'll catch them in the last week on prices. And you did.
Interesting.
Anyway, so Ted lost, and the Labour government. What happened? Another rerun of the same story, the winter of discontent, probably the worst manifestation of union militancy any government of the post-war world faced. We couldn't bury the dead because the undertakers were on strike. But that was just one of a vast range that destroyed Jim Callaghan's government. But the important point is Ted Heath's government, who'd lost in 74, came back. Different leader, but the same people. And those of us who'd fought through all this, we knew what had to happen. We had to change the law. We had to establish the fact that in the end there were rules and regulations and the trade unions must abide by them. And so here we are now, a long time. Most of it has been relatively a great improvement in public, industrial relations, a huge improvement, I would say, in the management of our companies as well. But what have we got now? We've got highly paid consultants on strike. And we've got junior doctors trying to recoup 35% pay increase. And what is it, 100,000 operations put off today? You can't run a country on that basis.
But, look, I'm very aware of the danger that I'm quite into this 1970s thing, and I could look at my watch and we could spend the whole hour. I'm going to try not to do that. I'm going to ask you one more question. I'm going to move on to Europe so we do that, and then we can come back to this if we have time. I mean, you said nothing has changed. It strikes me as a strange thing to say. I mean, the unions aren't what they were. It's a very different country now to what it was.
Well, they're not what they were because the law of the land was changed, making them, A, behave within the law, but also there were very significant restrictions on, a major shift from public sector to private sector, on the denationalisation programmes. And the private sector, by and large, is more fragmented and much harder to organise. And you could argue, debatable, the human resources industry has greatly improved within certainly the private sector. I just think that if you are dealing with huge bureaucracies, very difficult to find a way of avoiding the ability of groups of people to hold the country to ransom.
Okay. I'm going to come on to Europe now, because otherwise I'm going to get too into the 1970s. And in your autobiography, you talk about 1973 as being a watershed in British foreign policy when we joined the European Economic Community. What made you say that? Why was it such a watershed?
Because it recognised that the assumptions of the Second World War had changed. I, in 1955, went up to Oxford, and I helped to create an organisation called the Oxford University Blue Ribbon Club, which was an aspect of the Conservative Association, but European inclined. And the cover was blue, three interwoven circles, America, Europe, and Commonwealth. And that reflected the assumption of not just my new vision, but Commonwealth and America. And if one thinks back about, well, Messina, 57, why didn't we do it? And the reason we didn't do it was basically that we felt a close affinity to America, what some people call a special relationship, a huge loyalty to Commonwealth and Empire. I mean, incredible. Australia, New Zealand, Canada joined the war the day we declared war. And huge numbers of people from Africa and India fought and died for this country on our side. So the idea of abandoning all that and becoming part of Europe was just inconceivable in 1945. Although Churchill made, of course, one of his most important speeches, we must create a kind of United States of Europe. Not they must create, we must create a kind of United States. And of course, this was the day, this was the time of Jean Monnet and people like that on the continent, who harnessed the feeling of the men and women of the resistance movements and the prisoner of war camps. It must never happen again. Mm-hmm. But that, we were never occupied in this country. And we saw ourselves as being different because we were the launch pad of freedom being restored. So, the best answer to this question I know, and it's curious language, but it's very evocative. Michael Charlton did a series for the BBC called In The Price of Victory. And he interviewed all the people who played a role in government or in the negotiations at the time of the Messina Conference. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's absolutely fascinating, and it explains all this in very human terms. But to me, the chilling words that I have never forgotten coming out of all that was Rab Butler, who, of course, was a vitally important part of having created the recreated the Conservative Party after the Second World War, was asked about Messina, and he said, it just wasn't on. Wasn't on, you know. Of course, we were quite wrong, but it wasn't on. Now, that language you couldn't hear today, but the language then, it tells you everything. It just wasn't on. We never use those words now, but then it said everything, and it summed up that feeling about reliance on America, that feeling of indebtedness to Commonwealth and Empire, and somehow we were the people who had made all this freedom possible. It just wasn't on. But of course, we were quite wrong.
And in a sense, not being there at the start shaped what happened after we joined, because we joined a club that hadn't been made with our input, didn't we? So it all felt a bit...
Well, look, who ever takes account of anybody outside the membership? I mean, what's the point of joining a club if you're just going to be trying to work out how to look after people who are not members? I mean, so And what happened? Well, we all know exactly what happened. Basically, the French were very worried about the vast swathe of country to the south, which could easily have begun to become depopulated as the people left for the towns. The Germans wanted a bigger market for their industrial products. Deal? Yes. German subsidy to keep the French citizens in the countryside. At the Common Agricultural Policy. Mm-hmm. Well, if we'd been there, it wouldn't have been the same, because we would have had a very different view about the agricultural support system. But we weren't there. And so when the European community was then started, it was a deal between France and Germany, mm-hmm. Embracing another four countries. Well, you know, that's how it happened. And of course, you fast forward to 1986, I think, when Margaret created the single market. Mm-hmm. And what was that all about? We're never going to let the French and Germans do it again, because we had complained bitterly about the effects of why we had to abide by the European rules. So Margaret, I would argue, her single greatest achievement was the single European market. Margaret sent Arthur Cofield to Brussels. He was a tax inspector, a chartered accountant, the former cabinet minister, a very formidable man, to negotiate our interests in the single market. And there is no doubt at all that it was, from Britain's point of view, a very significant achievement in our self-interest, but in Europe's self-interest. And, of course, what then? It all went wrong, because it was the idea, talking to you here now, the audience listening, wonderful, single market, fantastic. But to the small businessman who was his own finance director, his own marketing director, his own salesman, his own production engineer, sitting, oh, my God, I've had a terrible day. Oh, it was another form. A directive turned into a regulation on his desk, complex, detailed, and another one yesterday, and two more tomorrow, because the single market needed a myriad of standard harmonization in which you embraced all the European nations' self-interest, but all their rules had to be put into one. And so by the end of the 80s, the feeling of them, Brussels, foreigners, was beginning to penetrate. And we have newspapers who are good at exploiting that.
Well, that was partly because Margaret Thatcher changed her tone, didn't she? I mean, from
she
sort of...
She changed her tone because she found that what she'd created was beginning to overwhelm her political loyalties. What she created was brilliant. The implementation of it was hard, controversial, essential, and, of course, much to our self-interest.
So would you agree then that, I mean, there was a case in favour to be made, but successive prime ministers, not just her, but actually her successors as well, just failed to go out and make that case? Is that one of the reasons why we ended up where we did? Because prime ministers wouldn't talk about the benefits of membership in convincing enough terms?
Well, I think that... I think that there was a change in tone. I think that John Major, certainly, I think Tony Blair, later David Cameron, all explained and supported the European Union as our membership of it. I think we did. I certainly have no recollections at all of anything other than maintaining the arguments for the case, although the Euroscepticism was rising. Mm-hmm. And it became very difficult by the time John Major had come to power, over Maastricht, for example, which we only won by one vote, if I remember correctly. And the Eurosceptics were then very powerful within the Conservative Party.
Well, let me pick you up on Cameron, at least. You say that he made the case. I mean, one of the problems with Cameron, surely, was He'd spent a lot of his time as Prime Minister moaning about the European Union, talking about how he hated going to European councils and would rather be anywhere else. And then all of a sudden, in February 2016, he was saying European integration is vital to our security. And everyone went, hang on, you've just spent 6 years in government saying, you know, being sniffy about the thing. Are you, yeah, can you really
I,
make
I that? Think that David was a European. Public opinion was in support of Europe by then. That one of the reasons why he went for the referendum, because he thought he'd win it. And the evidence was that he would win it. And that then comes to the whole question of the Brexit campaign and what was it all about and how did it go wrong. But I certainly think, and I have myself, I don't think that the government of that time fought the Brexit campaign as well as they should, because they did focus groups, and they found that the focus groups were on commerce, business, all these sort of rather, they're not sexy political issues. And so they thought that's where they had to go. I think myself what was missing in that campaign was the vision that led to the European Union in the first place.
Their vision or our vision, in the sense, you know, the vision of Messina or the vision of...
The vision that drove the European movement was missing in the referendum, the Brexit referendum.
But isn't part of the problem with that argument that you would have needed successive prime... You know, that view would have had to be inculcated prior to the referendum. You couldn't suddenly start talking about the European Union.
No, but you've missed the point. We were already... We were going to win the referendum. Public opinion was already in favour of Europe at the beginning. It was the campaign that upturned it over. So you have to look at the campaign. And remember, the lead-up to the Brexit referendum had been a very difficult period post-2008 when the world financial crisis took place. And people's living standards had basically remained static up to the referendum. And so, although on strict polling, Europe was in the lead, but... In people's feeling, there was a need for change. And, of course, what the Brexiteers did was to take the need for change and turn it into anti-Brexit. And the government was not as articulate, in my view, as it should have been in trying to separate the vision of Europe from the economic consequences of 2008.
Okay. I mean, the other thing from memory that was missing from that campaign was you, in the sense that, you know, just thinking back and having you sitting here now, it dawns on me that the Remain campaign could possibly have mobilised Tarzan to go out there and...
Well, I'll tell you why that happened. And forgive me, it's rather an arrogant story, but it happens to be the truth. At the very beginning of that campaign, I think it was a dinner, but it was a meeting, probably not much around this size, all party. And I was asked to speak at it, and I did. And one after the other, people came up to me and said, "We've never heard that before. We've never heard it put like that before. You know, you've got to play a big role." And that was the last time I had any official involvement in the campaign. Now, I did appear on programs and meetings, but never with the sort of full flair and panache
of the campaign.
No, that's right. And after the thing was over, I talked to a senior official in Number 10, and I said, "You remember that meeting when I had quite a success? Why did I never hear from anyone again?" He said, "Because you had appeared on a platform with Ken Clark, I think, and Tony Blair, in where the euro was being discussed. And the organizers of the campaign were frightened that if they used you, the conduct of the campaign would all be about the euro, and you, in me, I would say something that was not 100% black and white, and that would lose us the referendum. So that's why I was never used.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean...
I think quite wrongly, I have to say, because I think... I think...
If you do say so yourself.
Nothing I could do about it. I mean, they didn't want to use me. But I think I could have put a perspective into that campaign, which... Well, it became a very emotional campaign. And, I mean, a morally bankrupt campaign, but very emotional. And the side of the case that I understand is one of emotion. It's not, I know the economic and factual arguments as well, but it's the vision. It is 1,000 years of bloodshed in which politicians who failed send the younger generation to die. That's what Europe is about. And we have found a solution where we talk. Yes, it's boring. Yes, they're bureaucrats. Yes, you have to sit there and listen to people banging on. But we don't send generations of young people to die.
But there was another... I mean, there was another vision, wasn't there, which was 1,000 years of British history, the Gateskill line, you know, well, why would we throw that away?
And a 1,000 years of British history. What was it? One battle after another of the Europeans.
Okay.
We were up to here in it.
When you say the campaign was morally bankrupt, what do you mean?
Well, I'll tell you what the campaign was really about. Let's not muck about, you know. The campaign was about time for change because of the 2008 campaign. They wanted change. And so someone has to... If there's change, it's not your fault or yours or mine or yours. You've got to find someone else, haven't you? Someone else that rings bells, strikes chords, rises the temperature. Well, we all know who does that. They, them, it, Europe, officials, and one more? Res. And the underlying drive of Brexit was immigration. And was it 40 million Turks who are going to be allowed? 70 million.
I think it was 70 million.
70 million. What's 10 million here or there? 70 million Turks. What was that all about? Mm-hmm. Race, immigration. Mm-hmm. And that was led by people like Nigel Farage, exploited by Boris Johnson. That was the driver that tipped just by the narrowest of margins the British people over. Now, I lived through Enoch Powell's speech. I was the first Conservative to criticize him in 1968. Mm-hmm. I saw what race can do as an issue in this country, in any country. Look across the world today, it is disastrous, the racial conflicts everywhere. Racialism, tribalism, you know, just look around the world, it's everywhere. And so anyone in politics who knows about communication knows that if you want to stir things unforgivably, that's the place to go. And why Enoch's speech was immoral is because not only did it do it in spades with language which was inflammatory, there was not a shred of a sensible suggestion of what to do about it. So he stirred up the docker, the meat porters of Smithfield March. My constituents could hardly talk with. They were so carried away. And, of course, Ted sacked him, quite rightly. But, so I've lived through these manifestations of Brexit and immigration and all that twice. But you only have to go back to the 1930s to find some pretty chilling examples.
OK, well, let me just challenge you on that a little bit, because what we've seen since the referendum... I mean, paradoxically enough, is we've seen a massive increase in immigration from non-white countries.
Yes.
Nigeria, India, places like that. Yeah. And simultaneously, we've seen a softening of public attitudes towards immigration, which kind of belies your argument, doesn't it? So immigration of non-white people has gone up massively. Public opinion has softened. So how does your argument make sense?
Well, I can only tell you that I know what the situation was like in the referendum, mm-hmm. and that was the issue at the time. I haven't the slightest doubt that it was the tripping point. Now, you're quite right today, but equally, you know, you say public opinion has softened. Well, has the voice of parts of the British media softened?
No, but...
But you see, we've got to remember, if only 1% they won by, a huge proportion of the population weren't fooled by any of this. There were only sections. And the Red Wall, has attitudes changed there?
Yes.
Well, why do you think that neither of the big parties will talk about Brexit?
Okay, that's for the future. We will come back onto that, I promise you. But just sort of on this immigration point, I suppose what some of the leavers in the Conservative Party would say to you is it wasn't about race, it wasn't even about numbers, it was about control. And actually what public opinion post-referendum shows us is that that is what resonates with public opinion. The fact that we now get to choose who comes in with work visas and we no longer have freedom of movement.
No, I don't buy that.
I'm sensing that.
You're quite right to show that the immigration figures now, I think I'm right, you will know, are higher than we've ever had them. So the idea that was control was just part of the dialogue. It sounded good. Mm-hmm. The fact you couldn't do it, well, you know. So I think I'm the first to say I think this country is probably the best example in the world of a tolerance of a civilized society. I think it probably is. But that doesn't mean to say that everybody subscribes to that view. And I think the problem with the Red Wall, which is where it is perceived the balance of politics lies in the forthcoming election.
Misleadingly.
What?
Misleadingly. Because there aren't that many seats there, are there?
Well, there were quite a few. You may be right, but certainly the perception to the two main parties is that if you stir up Brexit and you stir up the Red Wall, and I think that the problem is rather interesting, really, because suddenly everybody's talking about parts of Europe, the Horizon programme, self-evidently, Northern Ireland, Macron's statement and Starmer's response. Mm-hmm. None of this has stirred up the Red Wall. But the issue is immigration. And the thing that really reinforces all of this is the boats, which where patently we've lost control. And my own view is clear. The only way we'll ever get control is on a pan-European basis. I think one needs to recognize that the frontiers of Europe are where the controls will need to be exercised, because Europe is a honeypot.
I mean, I've given up with these questions now, to be honest. What about the way that the EU is handling immigration at the moment makes you think that a pan-European solution is the answer? Because actually...
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's very worrying. You see, but it's the same issue, isn't it?
No, it is the same issue. It's on a far smaller scale here, it's worth saying.
Across Europe, you can see the rise of the right. And the reason that the right is rising, as it always was, mm-hmm. basically immigration.
And economy.
And yes, there's always been economics, you're quite right. But it's when they find who's responsible. when you're looking for someone to blame, then race is never far from the irresponsible right wing.
Okay. I want to circle back, because I'm not going to let you off the hook. I want to talk a little bit about your party in the years 2016 to 2020 and Brexit. I mean, what happened, I suppose, is, you know, seen through your eyes as you watched the Conservative Party do the things it did in that period and signed the sort of... You did our podcast, I think, in 2018, and I suppose the summary would be you were totally appalled. But looking back now...
I do podcasts every day. It's good.
Yeah, but ours is the one you remember.
Absolutely phenomenal. They never stop. where were we? What happened to the Conservative Party? Well, you have to... At the heart of it is Europe. That the Brexiteers, the anti-Europeans, became more and more powerful. They, of the leaders of the Conservative Party, there were three, Michael Howard, Ian Duncan-Smith, and Lord Hague, from the Eurosceptic side of the party. They didn't make progress. The Conservative Party did what it always does, reverted to the centre with David Cameron. And David Cameron, in my view, led a sensible government in hugely difficult circumstances because of the 2008 crisis, which went on and on. But if I think he made a mistake in giving a gesture to the Eurosceptics when he said he would leave the European People's Party. Mm-hmm. And there's a famous saying, you'll all know it, once you've paid the Dane geld, you'll never get rid of the Dane. And so that, they saw that as, you know, we can get this. And in the end, he felt that he thought he could win. And so he thought he could lance the boil. And that turned out to be wrong. And that's when Boris Johnson arrives on the scene.
I think Ken Clark had a great line, which was something like, feeding buns to the crocodiles is fine till you run out of buns.
Yes. Well, couple that with mine Danes and Dane Gallison, and you've got it all set out, yes. Yes, yes. No, I mean, I that's as you'd expect with Ken. It was very eloquent.
Now, watching Rishi Sunak bring about a very slow, halting, tentative rapprochement with the European Union, you know, if you think about the Windsor framework, you think about Horizon, very, very slow, small, very, very small steps, does it make you hopeful that we're moving in the right direction?
Yes. No, we will move in the pro-European direction. You know, what is it, 68% of the population now think Brexit is a mistake, or is it 61? It's a huge proportion now know that it's a mistake. And as time goes on, and as the age profile of the electorate changes, the younger generation become a larger proportion, then it will change more. And as experience, just of the loneliness of being outside and the futility of the things that were promised, you know, all these wonderful deals we were going to do all over the world, and where are they, you know, and were they wonderful, you know? I mean, I have a company which I started many years ago, and I was talking to the chief executive. We employ about 1,500 people. About half of them here, 500 in America, 50 in Germany, 200 in India, 100 in Hong Kong. This month, we've bought a company in Canada and a company in Holland. And so none of that has been affected by Brexit at all. And what strikes me is that if I was a manufacturer and I opened up a bigger market in Asia somewhere for my products, whatever they were, someone would tap me on the shoulder and say, why do you pay English salary rates when you can assemble your plants here in Asia at much cheaper wage rates? If you're a service industry, which I am, my company is, if you start in all these countries which we're in, you employ local people. Mm-hmm. You don't send a lot of expats out there. You know, in Hong Kong, we employ a lot of Chinese guys. And so I never could see what these fantastic deals were going to compensate for severing our relationship with someone 21 miles over the water. And so it was all just words, and largely words designed to appeal who perhaps didn't have quite as much experience of international trade or, in my case, international politics, and the reality of what we're up against in the world.
I mean, you seem very confident about this, but I mean, you know, alongside the 60-odd percent who think Brexit was a mistake, the other phenomenon in public opinion is that fewer and fewer people really care about it. I mean, the figure now is, I think, 7, 8%, down quite significantly in the last year. And
this is the point I made earlier. They didn't care about Europe. They cared about immigration.
No, but what I'm saying is, in order to make this, if you're a political leader now that wants to make this an issue, one of the constraints you'll face is that the public will think, you know, why are you focusing on this?
Well, that may well be, but if you can diffuse the issue, then there won't be such resistance. And people who have to make the decisions, as I have had to do on various occasions in government, mm-hmm. will be able to get ahead and do it without any aggro. So, I created the European Space Agency in 1973, I think it was. There was no fuss, except there was murmurings in Whitehall because they didn't want to see, Margaret didn't want the post office space activities handed over to the Europeans. The Ministry of Defence said it would sour the special relationship, but they left me free to go and create a relationship with Europe in which we all shared common programmes. If I give you the background to that, it tells you all you need to know about why we'll go back into Europe. Minister, would you be kind enough to sign this document here? It's just £6 million to give to a British space company, because you know those French and Germans have been subsidising their industry and we're getting a bit behind. Just sign here. I said, well, before I actually spend £6 million, tell me just one question. How much does Britain spend on space? How much does Europe combined spend on space? And how much does America spend on space? The British figure, I forget. The European figure was £200 million. The American figure was £1.2 billion. Mm-hmm. And so I said to officials, this is toy town, isn't it? You're asking me to try and compete with the French and the Germans. Why don't we put ourselves together and use that 200 million comprehensively? If I go fast forward, Minister of Defence in 1984, General Abrahamson came to see me. Mm-hmm. He was Ronald Reagan's choice to mastermind the Strategic Defence Initiative. Strategic Defence Initiative was a screen, an electronic screen that prevented missiles penetrating your airspace. Secretary said, I've got a budget of $29 billion. Just get that figure. $29 billion to execute this program. And Minister, I can spend $100 million today in Heriot Watt University, where they are at the leading edge of this or that technology. I heard him say, I have $29 billion, and I know where the leading edge of technology is in any part of the world, and I'm going to make partnerships with all of them. I didn't hear him say, and that will take all the technology back into Silicon Valley, just as the American space and defense program has created Silicon Valley. And that's why I'm a European.
Okay. I mean, your faith in sort of economic rationality to dominate politics is touching, but I mean, over, you know, if you, surely the last sort of 6 or 7 years have taught us that that sort of logic doesn't always triumph. So I'll tell you what, can you sketch for me what you think will happen over the next 10 years in terms of our relationship yes. with the European Union? Do you yes. think we'll go back in that time frame?
Yes.
How would that happen?
I tell you why I think. I think what will happen is what's already happening. You see, the Brexit case is disintegrating. And today, there's no one who believes that Brexit's been a success. The only people left with the Brexit stain on their conscience is those who say, we never had a chance to do it properly. You know, the fact they've been in power for 6 years, and they've had the levers of power in the hands of Brexiteers from the day that Boris Johnson and Liam Fox and David Davis became the Brexiteer champions in the new government. They have had their hands on the levers of power. And actually, what have they got to show for it? Virtually nothing. And so now they say, well, we've never given a chance. It's complete, I mean, absolutely unbelievable rubbish, but that's the truth of it. And that will gradually permeate through society, particularly as more and more people become involved in European activities. Horizons, Erasmus program, possibly, the veterinary agreement, but a whole range of other areas. And then people will realize, but the rules are being made by someone else. And then a politician will be brave enough to stand in this country and say, we're bigger than that. We should be helping with these rules. Now, I can't tell you what the crisis will be, whether it'll be environmental, climate change, taxation, avoidance, whatever it may be, but there are massive issues out there on the global stage mm-hmm. when Europe is more equipped. Immigration is one. Because how are you going to stop the boat people? I mean, one of the questions the Brexiteers can't answer, suppose it was the other way around, and it was from our country that the immigrants were going to France. Just imagine if the French turned around and said, you've taken back. I mean, what do you think the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph would say about that? You know? So the events are going to go, are already going our way. But the interesting thing is, and I repeat this, it is immigration that is the issue, not European rules or whatever. I'll give you another example.
But what changes that then in a debate about, I mean, you know...
Experience. The experience of showing that when you join the Horizon programme, not a hair of head was upset. Wall did not revolt.
No, but when you join the single market, it's a whole different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Because there's... Yes, because all sorts of companies will be saying we'll be able to get the export to there more effectively, etc., etc.
And freedom of movement.
That will have to be discussed, because it may be, yes, but then you've got the outer ring, you've got macro, and the new starting point, you see. So that's, I mean, I think it's quite, what Macron has said is very interesting. And you're quite right, you do come up against this question of who makes the rules. That's quite right.
But I mean, by sheer serendipity, you've answered a few of the questions there without me putting them to you, so that's good. But on Macron and these concerns, I mean, one of the interesting things about just how badly we in the UK misinterpreted yesterday's papers is half the authors have come out today on social media and said, actually, this associate status was never going to work for the UK because the UK won't accept single market membership because single market membership is indivisible. So I don't understand how you see that. We still have that hurdle of immigration that you spoke about so eloquently half an hour ago. That is a debate. It is hard to see a politician wanting to have, isn't it?
No, not when a lot of people have realised that there is an opportunity to improve our trade. And who knows what other things may be on the agenda in the climate change debate and all that sort of thing. And when public opinion has realised that the being part of Europe is not part of the racial immigrant issue, although it could be, and in my view should be, because I think we should. I think we need a Marshall Aid program in which Europe defends its frontier, which will be hard but necessary, but it coordinates its aid programs in order to stimulate wealth-creating opportunities in the countries from which people come. But what one has to realize, this is the problem, that everywhere in the world, in the most impoverished parts of the world, someone has got one of these. And they know how we live. They see the standards of living. They see what it's like. And if you're a 26-year-old guy with a wife and a young family, it'd be nice to share a bit of that. These are not people with their feet up, idlers, shirkers, whatever it is. These are the energetic, entrepreneurial, I want to get a better deal for my family. In the language of someone I won't refer to, they got on their bikes.
What do you make of Keir Starmer's approach to the European Union?
Well, it's not my job to advise leaders of the Labour Party.
But give it a go.
Yeah, no. Well, I will give you a historic word of advice. If you're in opposition, never have a policy. Absolutely never have a policy, because your job is to oppose. And whenever something goes wrong, you want to hammer the other guy. And when he's on the ground, you kick him, you know. If you have a policy in opposition, if it's any good, the government will immediately embrace it. And it will be long forgotten that you ever originated it. If it's a bad one, well, then you've got headlines in every right-wing newspaper in the country. You'll never talk about anything else. And you can see that's happening now, you know. I mean, day after day, it's fascinating just seeing the mechanics of politics. So Keir Starmer is coming under more pressure as the election gets closer. Mm-hmm. And he's beginning to open up a bit. And of course, the counterattacks are becoming more targeted. That's why we never want to have policies.
Is it your sense, though, that if he became Prime Minister, he would take us back closer to the European Union than if the Conservatives continued in power now?
No, I think Conservatives will do it as well. See, the Conservative Party is the most successful political party in the history of democracy. Why? Because it is essentially a coalition in pursuit of power. And to achieve power, you have to appeal to a large number of people, embracing a whole horizon of opinions. And the Conservative Party is brilliant at realigning itself, readjusting itself, regrouping to achieve power.
But you missed a bit, didn't you? I mean, it's a coalition in search of power whose leader is chosen by a massively unrepresentative, tiny segment of the population.
That's a mistake, but that's...
That's where we are, isn't it?
Yes, but that's uncharacteristic of the Conservative. But, you're quite right. And this will make it harder, unless, of course, the Conservatives in the House of Commons change the rules, mm-hmm. which they'd be perfectly capable of doing, and would and should. But equally, the Conservative Party is made up of, as I said, a broad horizon. But I know huge numbers of its activist members, and they're very practical people. They may well have moved to the right, but if they think they're going to lose, they'll move back to where they can win. And they'll follow a leader. The Conservatives are very, very much orientated. And David Cameron, you think about the sort of things that David talked about. Go love a hoodie, you know? And they loved it. And David did things which in appealing to certain groups that would not be natural allies of the Conservative Party. But he won an election, and they like that. So I tell you that although you're quite right, the leadership change is not the best thing that's happened. It could be undone, but even if it isn't undone, I have a working knowledge of those people, and in the end, they want to win.
So just to be straight, imagine Keir Starmer wins the next election.
Do I have to?
Just try. Shut your eyes. And imagine that the Conservatives have a leadership election straight afterwards, just hypothetically. Isn't the probability that they will get a far more pro-Brexit prime minister or leader?
Pro-Brexit
leader. Isn't the dynamic of the membership that they will go in that direction?
What, right wing?
Yeah, well...
No, they won't.
Okay.
No, they wouldn't. That's lost what they, this is not what the Tory party does. Tory party regroups for power.
Okay. Just, I mean, on the Conservative Party, and you spent a lot of time talking about the Red Wall. I mean, I'm not sure how to... Who are the Conservatives for, I suppose, is my question. I mean, who is the Conservative core voter? Because it seems to me that the party has a problem now, that they have lots of different sorts of votes. I mean, Boris Johnson put together a coalition.
What is it? The Tory party gets 13 million votes or something like that. How do you identify the core of 13 million?
Well, let me give you a practical example, OK, which is Rishi Sunak today, changing the deadline for getting rid of combustion engines, OK?
Well, now, let's get one, carried away. He's put it back 5 years.
Yeah, he's put it back. But what one logic is that this is to appeal to a certain sort of conservative. It's almost as if we appeal to those Red Wall voters who might be slightly more worried about this than others. But isn't he appealing to the wrong audience? Isn't the Conservative Party is a...
See, I don't think that is... it isn't... That programme is not for the Red Wall voters. It was Uxbridge that generated that.
OK, but...
And that was very much not Red Wall.
No, yeah. But... The people who are likely to not like it are the sort of liberal-leaning, blue-wall Tory voters who might flee to the Lib Dems, aren't they?
There will be a price to pay in what you call the green south of England. Mm-hmm. That is true. But if, as I suspect, we will hear a whole range of figures as to what it's going to cost people to implement the
to buy electric vehicles.
The agenda. I heard a newscast that was coming up. It was very, very brief, of course, but there was references to £10,000 a family and that sort of thing. Now I don't know what it's all about, but there will be figures, believe me, as to how, and in Uxbridge it was £12 a day to take your car into London. And when that is the language which has a certain sort of it's quite easy to understand. So we'll see but that's not Red Wall. Red Wall is a different issue. Red Wall you haven't asked me about. So that it's this is what I used to do when I used to go on the Today program. If I always had my answers ready. And if they didn't ask me the question, I would say, you haven't asked me the right question yet. So here I am on devolution. But that is about the Red Wall. And the devolution agenda, which David Cameron did a lot.
I had a whole section on devolution, but I kind of...
Well, I was helping you. Sorry about that. I was just helping. Because that is what a Conservative government should be doing, is devolution. Because this country is not well managed. And it is too central in London, it is too functionally divided, mm-hmm. and there is too little reliance on the spontaneity of the locality and the local different economies that exist. They're all different. Manchester's not Liverpool, Liverpool is not Leeds, Leeds is not London. These great economies which make up our country all have different strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats. And what we should be doing is to have mayoral authorities in some 60 authorities all devising their strategy locally, mm-hmm. and a central government working in partnership to help them achieve it.
But also, presumably, not just devolving political authority, but devolving budgetary power to that. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it?
Of course.
Do you think the Metro Mayors are a useful step in the right direction?
Oh, yes. I mean, that was David Cameron. And that was, I had the privilege of being a special advisor to Greg Clark and therefore George Osborne when we did it. And that you know, all of this was looked at by Redcliffe Maud in 1968.
Yeah.
And that's the last serious analysis of how you should run this country effectively. And there were 1,300 authorities then, and Redcliffe Maud said we needed 60. Well, I was a junior minister in the government that got it down to 300, and there's about 300 today. And we don't need 300, we need 60. And we need directly elected mayors so that there's a comprehensive accountability across the whole area, as opposed to a party. You know, you can have a Labour Party who won, we'll say, 55 council seats out of 100, and they don't need to worry about the 45. And the same is true of the Conservative Party. They win 55 councillors, they don't need to worry about the problems of the 45. But if you want to get to stimulate an economy, you have to draw together the strengths of the public and the private sector. You have to embrace the academics, the universities, the education people, the quangos, which are all independent now, mm-hmm. and are not in any legalistic way bound to take an interest collectively, and of course the huge private sector. An elected mayor, which is the international model, an elected mayor can draw these together and create a partnership and a fusion of local strengths.
I was struck by what you said about numbers of councillors. Are you a proponent of proportional representation for our electoral system?
No, I'm just talking about the facts of the matter.
No, but I just wondered whether those arguments had convinced you that...
The PR system would destroy the Labour Party and the Tory Party. Mm-hmm. That's what it would do. And so it would take some persuading for me to...
No one seems very unhappy about this, to be honest. I mean,
no, but I would need to be persuaded we'd get something better. You see, that's it. So it's like them. Oh yes, PR, have PR. That'll be wonderful. I would take some persuading that it would be wonderful. It might just slow things all up. Everything becomes a compromise.
But isn't one argument that precisely because everything becomes a compromise, the parties would have to talk to each other, and you wouldn't end up with a system where the new lot comes in and as a matter of principle scraps everything the old lot did, which means that policy is very haphazard, no long-term policy planning is possible.
It's worse than you're saying.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's worse.
Why?
Well, I was president of the Board of Trade, and I think I was the 13th in 11 years.
Yeah.
So it's not about one government changing to another, it's about one minister changing from another. And how on earth can you have a serious strategy if the tenure of ministers... I mean, I did 3 years in, I think, every job I had. But that's very exceptional. And that's an important part of it. And another important part of it, of course, is that a very significant number of politicians don't have any specialist knowledge or interest in the subject to which they're appointed. And I don't know how you cope with that. It's very difficult to, you know, because the House of Commons is not going to be full of technocrats, and it shouldn't be full of technocrats. But it takes... you've got all the problems of balancing the party interests and looking after the whip's recommendations and the geographic representation issues. All have to be balanced in a team of 80 people chosen from 300 people. Mm. So you've got 80 ministers, and you haven't got... It's not the widest constituency to choose from. But you have to do it.
Which prompts me to... We're about to run out of time, but it does prompt me to ask you one last question, which is an invitation to, I suppose, look at the past through rose-tinted spectacles. If you think about the political figures that you were in Parliament with, you know, your Barbara Castles, your Tony Benns, real giants, do you think the calibre of politicians is as high these days?
I'm often asked that question. And
really, how disappointing.
I find it very difficult to answer because I had one very real experience that when I left Margaret's government in 1986, you had Quintin Hailsham, Peter Carrington, Willie Whitelaw, a range of, I mean, these guys had fought in the Second World War. I mean, they were real giant figures, you know, old enough, I suppose, to be at least my father. Then I went back in 1990, and they were 20 years younger than me. And you can't see giants down the generation. You see giants up the generation.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, where is the Churchill today? You know, I can't see such a phenomenon. But events made him. If you think about it, I mean, his pre-war record was a pretty, you know, have an interesting debate about that. But I mean, what he did in the war is phenomenal. But wonderful description. A friend of mine got into the House of Commons in 1959, and he said that when Churchill went through the division lobbies, everybody stood back and watched history walk past. Isn't that lovely?
That's a nice phrase. Lord Heseltine, Michael, I mean, it amazes me to say this, but we've reached the end of our allotted time. I could have kept going for ages because I want to go back to the 1970s and talk about that, to be perfectly honest. However, let me just take this opportunity to thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's been utterly fascinating. We really enjoyed it too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.